Jean-Pierre and I go to France every year, and I always bring back bags full of products from the local pharmacies. Then I discovered French Pharmacy, the brand, which is based on France's highly curated pharmacies. The line is formulated and committed to high-quality, results-driven products. With an ethos that combines the simplicity of the French beauty routine with a deep appreciation for the environment, French Pharmacy creates a sensible, uncomplicated skincare, including a brightening, exfoliating mask and an oil meat serum. French Pharmacy is on the beauty bestsellers list of luxury e-retailer Moda Operandi. The Elixir Exfoliant and Serum Radiant are included in Lauren Santo Domingo's edit on modaoperandi.com. I personally love the glow that I get from the Serum Radiant. Head over to modaoperandi.com and see for yourself why we love French Pharmacy so much. That's modaoperandi.com, modaoperandi.com. I'm Quinn Murphy, and this is In My Chair.
Former American Vogue editor Lauren Santo Domingo is the co-founder and chief brand officer of Moda Operandi. Santo Domingo began her career in fashion, working as an assistant at American Vogue. She then became PR director for Paris-based furrier Jay Mendel, and also served as the lead of the PR department of Carolina Herrera. Lauren returned to Vogue in 2005 as managing editor and then contributing editor. Lauren sits on the board of directors for Moda Operandi and Save Venice, a not-for-profit dedicated to the conservation of the arts in Venice, Italy. Regarded as one of the most influential women in fashion, Lauren was inducted into Vanity Fair's International Best Dress list in 2012. Lauren lives in New York City with her husband and her two children. Lauren, welcome In My Chair.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. Now, when you get into the Vanity Fair International Best Dress list in 12, does that mean you have it every year, therefore, after?
That's a good question. I think once one has been in it quite a few times, they move you over into the Hall of Fame so that they can retire you.
Okay. Well, they should send you a little card or something every year that says you're still in it. You know, don't get hurt feelings.
There used to be a plaque, like a Lucite. I think once you get into the International or the Hall of Fame, they send you a Lucite plaque.
I'm only in the Tri-State Area award for it, so mine's actually just on a laminated piece of paper.
Well, it's important to have goals in life.
So here's a question I was going to ask you later on, but I just looked over at my notes and it's staring at me.
Yeah.
Everywhere I looked online researching for this interview, they refer to you as a socialite. Is that a pejorative? And do you consider yourself to be a socialite? And then I want you to explain what is a socialite.
Okay. I mean, sure. I'm not against it. I embrace multi-hyphenate names. I suppose it was once a woman whose influence, important standing, soft power came through their attending of important events. And I think for a certain amount of time, you know, women just didn't have that many opportunities to hold important positions of power. And so that was an avenue that was open to women at a certain time. To me, it sort of characterizes a, you know, days long, long gone. But I think now it would just mean someone who goes to parties, is photographed, dressed well. And certainly there's, you know, nothing wrong with that.
No. Yeah. And so today, the version of it, like, I guess there were rules back then about what one would have to, like, be a part of to be in like the 400 club. But today, could you be like a tech entrepreneur and be considered a socialite?
I mean, now I think you would consider like the Kardashians.
Really?
Socialite. I feel like anyone. Yeah, it seems okay. It's open opportunity, I think. I mean, there was always a, it used to be that actually really proper women, one was only supposed to be in the press when they were born. And when they were married, or maybe maybe married and dead. Can't quite recall. So there was a time where, it was being in the press was actually looked down upon. When I arrived in New York, there was a bit of that sort of snobbery. And I remember sort of thinking to myself, I had just arrived from, Connecticut by way of California, and I didn't have a long history, a family name, a legacy that I had to protect. So I really didn't subscribe to that. And I think to be honest, it gave me, being a socialite gave me, like a position and a voice and a certain platform to move about the fashion world. So it was something that I, strategically took advantage of, one could say.
That's interesting. How important is it for you, like, I guess in the beginning, very, and still today, that you participate in the social events and going to things? Like, does it feel like it's a soft way of supporting your brand or who, like, your work life to go to social events and parties?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that. I mean, I think it's probably with your, it's similar with your friends and family, right? There are certain things you're excited to go to, other things you're not. There are certain commitments that family commitments or, friends commitments that one has to show up for to support. And I think that the same philosophy would apply to going out for me professionally. There's some I have to, some that I want to, others that are a bore. But so I think it all depends. And I would probably be using the same judgment towards, what events I'm going to professionally as I would, in my personal life also. Mm-hmm. I do feel a sense of duty to go to things and to support people, events. That's just I think that was instilled in me, old world, fashion. Being there for people was really important. And, there is even sometimes not being somewhere, could be like a declaration of war if someone didn't show up to something. So, I sort of subscribe to, those old world fashion values where one's presence is incredibly important and meaningful. And I always try to show up for people.
Have you gotten ever an unexpected advance in life from going to an event that you wouldn't have if you hadn't gone? Like, you met that person, or just being there, you were considered for, a position somewhere.
I am absolutely sure, 100%. I can't recall any specific, but I do think that, there's just an opportunity to be in front of people outside of an office or a meeting that has always been incredibly important. I think once we really settle into life again, post-lockdown, post-Zoom, that those face-to-face contacts will be even more important. Yes, I mean, I can't really, really recall.
I'm always on the fence if it matters. Like, when I'm invited to like some PR event, I'm like, is it going to do anything? You know what I mean? I mean, in the end, if you want to get to where you want to go, you should go, because staying home will not get you the result you want. But it's hard. Sometimes you go, oh, I just don't want to go.
I know.
Not that I'm invited to as many. Like, how many events would you say, for people listening, that you go to a week?
I think it probably appears I go to a lot more than I do. But, there's sometimes when I could be out 4 days a week, and then there's others I can have 4 weeks doing nothing. So it really depends. There's definitely a season, whether a social season in New York or fashion weeks around the world, There's definitely a lot to do. There is a joke someone once said that if one wanted to go to a black tie event in New York City every night of their life, they could. And I think that's absolutely true. I'm quite lucky. When I was really, going out and out on the scene, first of all, it was really fun back then. There was no social media, so people could get a little looser than they do now. And I was young, so I had stamina. My friends were going out. It was the type of thing where, you know, if you had to go to some sort of boring event, we would all end up at Beatrice Inn or Bungalow 8 or, you know, somewhere afterwards. So
on a school night.
On a school night, absolutely. So I
think you only go out on a school night, right? Like you stay in on the weekend.
Yeah, weekends are for amateurs.
How do you, so first of all, that was like, don't you think people were cooler back then? Like there's something about the fact that everything can be seen, that it takes out the mystique or the like kind of eliteness of the time.
I mean, I think it was more fun. People were a lot less concerned with how they were perceived, their image. I think making mistakes or were a bit more tolerated. And then also, you know, it wasn't expected that everyone knew everything about you. And one party picture could suffice, and people would be more than content with just seeing your outfit and moving on. Now it's about really creating a brand a bit more than it used to be. So people just were a little more relaxed back then, just because there weren't cameras, there weren't iPhones. I mean, I'm probably,
you could actually like not think about yourself all night
at all.
Yeah.
You would really go out, get the photo and then have fun for the rest of the night.
What about in terms of wardrobe? Like did you ever repeat clothes like, you know, 10, 15 years ago? Whereas now it feels like you have to constantly come out with something new to be photographed.
I don't really feel that pressure to wear something new. I'll wear something over and over again. I may only post it to my Instagram, once, but I will wear things over, and over. I have no problem with that. If I love something, I really, you know, it wouldn't make sense for me to only wear something once. That's what
I'll wear the exact same outfit in a row if no one saw it.
Yeah.
If I'm just feeling it, I'm like, oh, no one saw this one. That didn't count. I'll change the undershirt and wear it again.
Yeah. Even if people have seen it, I mean, working at Vogue, Anna Wintour, she had, very much a uniform, a style. She would repeat looks and, you know, working at Vogue where it was incredibly fashionable, I never felt pressure to be wearing fashion, new outfits, designer brands.
You did not.
Not at all. Not
like you could show up in what would have been Zara back in the day at Vogue.
All I wore was Zara. Yeah. I would go to like Woodbury Commons outlet on the weekend from time to time. But no, there was really no pressure for people working at the magazine to be, to be wearing brands or, you know, not repeating outfits. That was, you know, we were much more focused on the job and the work and the photos in the magazine and ultimately what the models were wearing. And
right.
Not what we were wearing. And I think that has stuck with me. When you have, someone like Anna Wintour who's setting the example. So I sort of subscribe to that to this day. I have no problem. If I wear something, friends will be like, oh, I love that dress. I haven't seen it since so-and-so's wedding. And it's like seeing an old friend. So I have no problem.
I think it shows you have personal style that you can have, that it's actually something that you like and can mix and match and, you know, as opposed to just wearing looks that are, you know, sent to you all the time, like we see so much.
And to me, it sort of gives importance to something. If I really like something, I did invest in buying it or tracking it down, that of course I would wear it again. And it would just show how important it is to me and how much I like it and how it speaks to me. And I want to wear it, to show it off, to share it. And doing that only once would probably not satisfy me.
So speaking of Vogue, when you moved to New York, did you know that you wanted to work at Vogue and had a clear kind of trajectory for your career?
Good question. I mean, I think working at Vogue at that time was like the ultimate dream. It would have been like getting into Harvard.
Right.
And it really was like that. And I was probably in New York for 1 or 2 years before I figured out, I interviewed a couple times for a couple different jobs that I didn't get at Vogue.
Oh.
Yeah.
Where did you land when you were at Vogue? Were you working right like Anna Wintour's assistant or?
I was working in the market department. So my job was to get the clothes from the PR for the fashion shoots. So Grace Coddington would be shooting a urban resort story. And so she would select her looks from all the runway shows. She would make her selection. And then off we would go and we would be calling Gucci, Helmut Lang, Valentino, Prada, getting those looks that she wanted. From there, she would edit them, style them down, do fittings, and then ultimately take them to the shoots. And, you know, those would end up on the pages. And it was incredible, obviously, you know, I sort of took it as I took it as seriously as I said, okay, this is my job. So my job is to get this dress to Grace Coddington for her shoot. And, you know, say it was on a Gucci campaign in the desert. And Grace needed it. I would go on Facebook. I would find someone, friend of a friend whose sister was getting married in Egypt. And there were people coming home from the wedding. And I would somehow get that dress in their suitcase and meet them at JFK and put it on the rail. And Grace would say, oh, it's 10 minutes late.
Right. I was going to ask, so was it the expectation that you would do whatever you had to do to get the job done? Or was that just you going above and beyond?
I mean, that was definitely me going above and beyond, but there was no, I just loved what I did. I'm not good at hearing no. And, you know, for me, it was exciting. And I never wanted to disappoint anyone. And, so I would always just go, yes, above and beyond. That's just sort of, you know, my nature.
Was it a hard job?
Sure. But I loved every second of it. I will never complain. I loved every second of it. It was a lot of, you know, main character energy. It was really, really exciting to be there. Felt like, you know, I was just in the center of the fashion universe and witnessing greatness and was so proud of every issue. That we put out and being able to flip through the magazine. And, you know, even if it was a sash that I had tracked down to make it to the shoot in time, I love to just flip through, you know, the magazine and to say, oh, I worked on that. And I did that. And to this day, you know, if on Instagram, an old photo popped up, I think for Christy Turlington's birthday, there was, this Vogue cover of her in a yoga pose, that was making the rounds on Instagram. I remember being like, I called that dress in. I got that on the rack. That was all me.
Wouldn't have happened without me, yep. Guys. Fashion history right here. Yeah. What about, were you allowed to meet the like really influential people and make an impression or as at the level that you were at, say like Mario Testino would know who you were or even, you know, Anna or something?
I mean, it depends. Like, you know, Mario was much more friendly. He was interested in the assistants on set. You know, but then you had like a Steven Meisel. It was a closed set, no assistants. And, you know, I would never get within, 50 feet of him. So it depends. But there is definitely, you know, at that stage in my life, I was learning from observing. And there were very few instances where, even if I had an opinion, that I was qualified to give it. I think, you know, I don't know, there was a bit of a hierarchy back then, and you were meant to sort of keep your mouth shut. And thank God that I did, because anything that I would have said as a 25-year-old market assistant to a great editor or great photographer would probably have been quite stupid. So I'm glad that I didn't have the opportunity to really, you know, give my input on things back then.
Do you think that the training that you went through, sometimes I feel like this in my life, like we learn to make an abacus and that's just not relevant today, but we spent years apprenticing to learn how to make this thing that now you don't need it. Like the people who are big, who come up, who are making waves, like they didn't assist for the poverty level for 4 years, and it doesn't really matter.
I know. I mean, I think us old-fashioned people talk about it all the time. I mean, even, you know, how we would dissect every season when, you know, the September issue would come out, which photographer shot what, which model, who did the hair and makeup, looking at every credit. I mean, that stuff, those statistics were so important. Now there's no one I could even have that conversation with. So, I mean, as you said, an abacus, I mean, is it that once a calculator is invented, we shouldn't use it because it's not fair to the people who, you know, had to work from an abacus for so long. So I see it as, I see it as it's a different generation, and hopefully there are always going to people who want to go the extra mile. When I was young, I remember Grace Coddington made a Peter Lindbergh reference for a shoot that she wanted to do on the beach. And I went back to my desk assuming that it must be an aviator theme shoot, not knowing who Peter Lindbergh was and thinking it was the pilot Charles Lindbergh. So I immediately thought, okay, I need to learn my references. And I went down to the Condé Nast library and I learned my references. Would go to bookstores on the weekend and look at monographs of designers or photographers and really try to get a sense of fashion, understanding I was working with people that had been in the industry their entire lives, and I'd been there 2 years and had a lot of ground to cover. And I think today, I think it's a mixed bag. Some people are coming in age 25 with ton of references because they've had the internet at their disposal their entire life, and they know more at 25 than I know now. And then there are others who, you know, don't need it, and maybe they have other skills, or those references could hinder them, because now people are looking at things. You know, we want people to come in with new ideas. So I think it's a mixed bag, and it's just in every industry as things change. How much are we nostalgic for the past and how we used to do things? And, what does it look like going forward and finding the progress and the beauty in that?
Are you good at, are you kind of malleable that you can say, okay, I did all that, but I'm here now?
Yeah. I mean, I'm nostalgic for it. I loved every second of it, but I don't think that, I just think some people have in them certain qualities or characteristics that it doesn't matter their work environment or their, you know, access to references, that they will go the extra mile. And that can't be taught. It was definitely nurtured in me because I was in an environment that really encouraged people to work hard and do their best and to, constantly try to improve. And I just think that it's in people, and hopefully they're in an environment that can help to nurture someone's best qualities.
Yeah, it's funny because there was definitely a toxic environment in fashion, and it was kind of celebrated, but also you had to like survive that. And so we didn't have a lot of boundaries. It was like you were in your place and that was the system, and you had to like really go to boot camp and work your way up. The generation now has much more clarity about like what's toxic, what should be expected, their weekends, like not being a slave to the system, right?
Yeah.
Do you find that? And because now you're on the other side of it, you're the head of a company. Do you find the difference between the Gen Z and, you know, us?
I mean, I'm happy that things have changed. As much as I, as I think back then, a toxic work environment was aspirational. That was an aspirational workplace. And there are so many boundaries, whether it's with models and exactly.
Now.
Yeah, there's so many more boundaries and safeguards to protect people. And I don't subscribe to the idea that just because I suffer that others should too. So I think it's great that the world and the industry, you know, is changing. And just like our parents would, you know, say the same things. You have no idea what it was like when I was a kid. And, you know, so I just think it's natural that each generation is a bit, and maybe not even nostalgic, but glamorizes, what it was like when, you know, I certainly.
Does it make it sanitized though, that like Stephen Klein's not shooting at 4 a.m. to get that shot that ended up being incredible that now, you know, people want to go home at a decent hour?
But we had to shoot until 4 a.m. because we didn't have a Digitech on set who could move one head to the other and change the lighting. And, you know, we had to
wait until
4. It was we didn't have necessarily the tools available to us. So I think there's a bit of that, too. The technology has changed. It's made it easier for us to do our jobs. I mean, when I was tracking down clothes, I was sending in faxes. I think style.com was I think email and style.com were maybe by the second season I was at Vogue, we were using them. Before that, it was faxes and someone would take photos at the end of a runway. I would take them to Alkit. They would develop them. And we would create, we would create our own lookbooks before the fashion houses, created their own bound books and sent them to us. So things just took longer back then.
And it was a smaller industry too, probably.
Definitely. Definitely. And now there's more voices, more points of view. It's open. There's so many more people consuming fashion content, and everyone, you know, there's sort of a niche for everyone, which is I think is rewarding to see that the industry has sort of evolved from a very tight myopic view to something much more open now. Lots of different points of view. Lots of different sort of niche ecosystems.
I agree. And as much as we might criticize social media, it has allowed a democratization of the industry with more voices, more points of view, better representation of races, of body types and genders. So we have to take the bad with the good.
Yeah. I mean, we were laughing the other day. We were at a show in Paris and it was, you know, like the hit show, the most viral, the Coperni show. And it was the biggest hit of Paris Fashion Week. I had family members that have absolutely no connection to fashion whatsoever asking me about it. It was like an incredible moment, similar to, you know, when Alexander McQueen did that robotic painting look. And, you know, in days past, the designer, when they reached that status, it was sort of expected that suddenly they would be shielded off by PRs, not giving interviews, be total jerks, and they would have to be exclusive to the point of ludicrous. Mm-hmm. To that's just what you would do. And you know, the Coperni boys are gracious and lovely and thoughtful and grateful. And the care that, you know, they took in making sure Bella was comfortable. And, it just, as I was sort of sitting there thinking how different it was and how far we've come, and that was such a safe and beautiful, moment. And the designers were so gracious. And
how long did it take when you were sitting there for that whole thing?
I don't know, maybe like 11 minutes, 17.
Oh,
minutes.
Wow.
It was great. I mean, it was really, really, a moment. And I find when those moments transcend fashion and reach a broader audience, that it's the greatest thing for our industry. And they did an incredible job. And yes, are just lovely. And most of the new designers, if not all of the new designers that are, you know, coming up today, are lovely and kind. And, you know, they're not shielded by PRs and, you know, being, you know, bitchy or cunty or obnoxious. It is.
But they have to have PR.
They do, but it's not as a, you know, a gatekeeper as it used to be. You know, you couldn't get away with being a jerk now, nor do they want to be.
Remember when backstage, I used to go to models.com to get clues about what was happening backstage in Paris and stuff. And it used to be like one photographer got to take a few photos back there. And then it changed when you actually would be like, no, Pat McGrath's going to do an interview and tell you about the look. And I remember it was like seeing that backstage then became super crowded and populated with people, and it just opened everything up.
Yeah. And then also, you know, there was no, I too used to love the backstage content of seeing the makeup artists walk through their looks and the palette. And you would, you know, still photographers would take out the light ring and models would be in the corner, you know, getting that perfect shot of the beauty, which would be included always in the runway review. But if you remember, what happened is that what we weren't acknowledging where there were models changing into their looks in the background. And there was no courtesy or thought to shield them or protect them from live cameras. So that's when the backstage became closed off. So yes, while I'm totally nostalgic for those days, we don't do that anymore for a reason. And, you know, until you hear that every model is dressed, no one is getting backstage. So it absolutely changed the dynamic of the backstage, but for good reason.
I actually never thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Or at least in my timeline, that's how I see the backstage having changed.
Lauren, you had a formidable career before Moda Operandi. You could have just, you know, probably had a lot less on your plate. You ended up having two children. What was the impetus behind starting Moda Operandi?
Let's see. So, you know, the idea of these runway looks going down the runway, and the only people that were at those fashion shows were really buyers and editors, and they were closed to the public. You know, maybe there would be a few socialites in the front row, and they would have their run of show and they would circle the looks that they wanted and would place a personal order. After that, those clothes would maybe, there would be trunk shows where the designers would pack them up and send them to Dallas or New York or LA, where women could go in and pre-order their clothes. And at some point, it was really sort of after the recession of 2008, I guess it was, that really stopped. And trunk shows stopped. It was just an expense and no one was, no one was really shopping that way anymore. And so I was approached by a woman, her name's Aushlag Magnusdottir, that I had worked with on several freelance projects, and understood we had very complementary skill sets. So she came to me with an idea that I sort of tossed around for a bit, and wasn't quite sure how it would work. And then I had my own experience where I was at a show, a Prada show, a look went down the runway, and I decided that, you know, it was something that I wanted to wear to an upcoming wedding and could not find it. I called, you know, various boutiques and department stores, and you know, if I found one, it had just sold, or maybe it was in the wrong size. And then I realized that as the runway was becoming more open, there was street style. You know, Instagram had just started. And suddenly the broader world was much more keyed in to what was going on during Fashion Week. And suddenly the idea of these, you know, looks going down the runway and women not being able to get their hands on them, a certain subset of women, of course, to me, it made sense to, you know, to to try to bridge the, you know, to connect the designer to this women in a way that they had stopped doing once they stopped doing trunk shows and things like that. So just bringing a very old world concept of trunk shows online. And at that time, everyone, that's sort of what the, you know, tech companies were doing, just taking all forms of commerce and moving it online.
Did you have any idea about how much work it was going to be? As I'm starting the small little thing right now, and I think that the naivete is powerful, because if you actually end up knowing how much work and everything that goes into it, you might not do it.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that's why the passion to really do something has to be there, because when it gets hard or tricky, which it always does, you have to be able to tap back into that passion and excitement that you once had to keep going. So I think because I was, you know, things that I have sort of thought about or started or half started were things that I weren't super passionate about. And this is always something, you know, connecting women with fashion has just always, it has always been, you know, what drives me. I love fashion. I recognize the transformative powers of fashion and how the soft power of fashion, of wearing a new dress can make one feel, and the excitement that comes from newness every season is just something that really, really excites me. And that's always been my passion, to connect women with fashion. And I feel like I've always been in a very unique position where I am very much at the center of fashion, but then I am also very much at the center of the non-fashion world, surrounded by women. And I want them to love fashion and interact with fashion and enjoy it and appreciate it, to love the designers and to be educated about the designers and what they're presenting every season. That's just what drives me and what I love. And it's hard to be, I always think I've chosen the right industry because the second I get bored, there's a new season. Right. There's always a new season around the corner, a new trend, a new movement, a new designer. So it's impossible to be bored. There's always something new to discover or to talk about.
Well, the flip side of that, Lauren, is that it is an industry that is very based on trend. It's very, you know, volatile at times. How do you keep it for you? How do you keep things real for yourself in an industry that can make many people feel like there's nothing, there's no stability, or there's nothing that it's going to ultimately give back? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But then, I mean, I sort of disagree. Then, you know, I then it's like, what's the point of putting out a book that someone will read once and never see again? Or what's the point of an artist, you know, doing a show that doesn't contribute anything? I think that fashion is like music, is such an important indicator of our time, of our culture. And in fact, when people look back and we think about periods of history, we always think about what they were wearing. So I just think it has a lot more importance in history than we give credit to.
But on an interpersonal level, haven't you ever felt burned out or kind of like used by the industry? How do you keep yourself in it without feeling wounded or taken advantage of? And I know I'm projecting when I say this, because maybe you haven't.
You know, I've been in this industry, I suppose, since, you know, for almost 25 years. So many of my close friends, we started together as interns and are in various levels of our careers. Some have moved out of fashion into, you know, maybe adjacent industries. And having that shared experience, I think, and being able to laugh about things is sort of, for me, has been really useful. But I think it's what keeps me going is I recognize change and I recognize where we're moving. And I'm really proud of how the fashion industry is trying to change. And I want to be a part of that. I want to be a part of this change for the better. And I'm really proud of the industry, of the efforts of the industry that I'm seeing across the board, more so in fashion than in many other industries. Perhaps we were overcorrecting, that we needed to overcorrect. But yeah, I want to be a part of fashion as it moves forward, and to try to grow and change and to be better and to do better. I don't think I'd be happy if I just packed it up in 2010 and left the industry as it was then. And I think seeing how it's changing is really, you know, important to me.
Do you have fear of failure?
Oh my God. Yes, absolutely. I definitely do. But then, you know, you also have fear of success. Like, oh God, if this works, that's, you know, a whole, you know, there's a lot of work that comes with it. I definitely have fear of failure. I am pretty, I guess like critical is the word, you know, self-critical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm definitely demanding on myself.
Has it ever paralyzed you or from doing something that you wanted to do?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, I can't think of examples, but I mean, a trick that I've sort of learned is, I guess I'm like a really big picture person, and I tend to see things really big. If I am working on a project, I can really imagine what it looks like when it's done. And it's, you know, it's so big and so vast that sometimes it can be hard to take that first step, because the finished product feels so, so big and so far away. I've been in the past paralyzed to take that first step because it feels so far away and so unattainable or unreachable. And I've now sort of taken the approach where I want to think smaller and think more about the first two or three steps and focus on things that are attainable, and try to move away from this, you know, dreaming and manifesting. It is sort of what we've been taught to do, is to, you know, imagine and manifest this ideal vision of something that we want. And I found that it can hold me back a bit.
Is that what you meant when you tweet, you had in a story recently on Instagram that you no longer want to focus on big things, on what's next, what's new, what's bigger, what's better? Yeah. Where did that come from?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, focusing on you know, the first steps, what's directly ahead of me. And of course I have an end goal in mind, but rather than sort of spinning my wheels dreaming and imagining, I want to spend that time acting and taking small important steps towards something, meaningful steps. And I think,
but you've accomplished so much that the other one, the dreaming, must have worked for you.
It definitely, yes, I think so, but I haven't stopped doing that. So I haven't stopped sort of continuing to, you know, think of what's next for Moda, where's it going? What can we do next? And it's hard to focus on the, you know, on the less, the smaller, important, but less lofty, ambitions when you're.
What I'm hearing too, is that maybe you don't give yourself enough credit or satisfaction for the things, for where you are. If you're always looking ahead, I do that all the time. I'm never value what I'm doing in the moment because I'm always thinking about where I'm not, you know, yet. It's a big problem.
I think everyone does that, right? I think we're programmed to always be reaching for something that we never take the moment to really, you know, congratulate ourselves for where we are. I think we all do that.
But it's caused me a lot of pain because I'm constantly saying, feeling this is where I want to be. This didn't happen the way I want. I want this, you know, whether it be the podcast, this is where I, you know, would love it to be. This is where I would want my career, instead of going, well, you know what? It's actually really fun to record a podcast. And I find that I deny myself the pleasure of actually doing what I'm doing when I'm only focused on where I'm not.
Yeah. I think we're saying the exact same thing.
You
imagine where you want this to be and you want to achieve this greatness and to, you know, reach a certain level, that then the actionable steps to get there in front of you are sort of being ignored, or don't seem, or you doubt that they'll be enough to ever get you there. I totally feel that. So let's take a moment. Mm-hmm. Really feel great about ourselves.
And that's the thing, is that dreaming is an important part. I'm not trying to eliminate it, because I have to believe that Andy Cohen's going to listen to this and put me on Sirius Radio or something. Otherwise, I won't do it. But I also have to believe that. I also have to honor that, like, it's fun. Like, if we were just having a conversation at a coffee shop, I'd really enjoy that. So what's the difference? You know, like, I'm doing this because I want to.
That's exactly how I feel. And I think what I'm, you know, what we're both saying is that when you create, it's maybe just limiting expectation or managing disappointment, because mm-hmm. you're imagining something, you know, you're imagining this end product, and you imagine it and you spin it and you weave it and you, you know, imagine what it's like when it's finished. When you're not there, it's a bit disappointing. And then suddenly the day-to-day seems like a grind. So I sort of am refocusing my energies just to avoid that disappointment and to, I was reading the other day, someone was saying that, how do I stop from imagining, a life, a complete full life with a guy I've been on two dates with? And I thought that was really, I mean, obviously I'm not dating. I've been happily married for 15 years, but I thought, like, I guess we all do that in some way. We imagine this, you know, we can just sort of go into a, you know, into a spiral, I suppose, of imagining the way that something should be and could be, and, you know, putting all our imagination and creativity into this, you know, this dream that probably is not going to happen. Or if it does, it's going to take a long time.
It's going to be nothing like the way you imagined it. That I know.
Yeah. And it could not happen, right? Or take a different turn. Like, that person will probably not end up with that guy, but with someone else without even realizing it. So I think we all do it in some way. And I wonder if this whole manifestation, you know, has been put into our heads, where we've really been taught to, that's how I feel, that we've been taught to just imagine things and that they will materialize because we've imagined them and we can see them clearly, or we've made a mood board. But that's just not reality. You know, great to have dreams, great to be able to see it, to taste it, to feel it. But the steps that we need to take to get there are what we need to focus on every day.
Absolutely. And speaking of every day, I wanted to just ask you, at Moda, what do you really value in the workplace? Just people around you that are the most talented? Are they bluntly honest? Or is it just people who, like, deliver and bring in the sales, who, you know, what at this point in your work environment is important to you?
What I really see is, I see people that love fashion and want to connect women with fashion. And I see a lot of, people that are similar to me, in that they're excited about newness. And that every time there's a new season or a new fashion week, that people are excited. And, We are really lucky in New York. We're the only US-based luxury e-commerce business. That's it. We're the only ones. So we can attract the most creative and talented people in New York. Our creative team, our buying team, our marketing team is world class. So I feel really lucky to have an incredible team. And in a lot of ways, to what I was saying before, as much as I know historically, I learn so much from the people that I work with, the creatives in my office. They're like I was then. They're on the ground. They know the best photographers, the best models, the coolest makeup artists. Like, they are in it. I couldn't possibly have the knowledge, you know, with the knowledge they have today is what I like to think was the knowledge I had, you know, in the aughts.
Well, that was one of my questions for you, because when I think of you, I think of someone who knows all of the best people. Like, you're almost, I think of you almost like a talent scout. Like, you work with the best architects, the best interior designers, the best landscape artists, the best hair and makeup, the best party planners. Do you like, if I was like, oh my God, Lauren would know what the best like goblet glass is to have on the table for the party that had this theme, I know you would know it, or you would know who to ask.
Yeah. It's like, I have some friends where I'm like, I need the best doctor or physical therapist or, you know, educational support. Nobody is coming to me asking me those things, but they are asking me, you know, about wedding planners and tailors and facialists and landscape designers and architects and all of those people. And, you know, I do have to say most of those people have been in it for a while, you know, like you, like, you know, that's how I mean, you're one of the best in the industry, and I've known you for a while. And so all those people that I'm talking about are people that have come up with me and have earned it. And 5 years ago would not have recommended them, but today they're the best. You know, they were always on their way to being the best. But it's a long,
do you have to have the best taste, Lauren? Like, is that important to you? Because I look at like your homes and like everything that you do, and I'm like, it's so tasteful and chic.
Why, thank you.
But are you competitive about that? Like, is it important for you to think that people look to you for that?
No, not really. As a, you know, I mean, I certainly would be, you know, if someone were to call me a tastemaker, I could say that label fits, but it's not my end all, you know, that people see me as supremely chic. But it is, I mean, I do, in the way that I love fashion, I'm just drawn to beauty and to beautiful things. And a lot of times, you know, I mean,
but you're now the face of Moda Operandi, and there's blogs about Lauren's edit, Lauren's pick. This is what Lauren would do. What does that feel like, that now, instead of that, you have this kind of brand, but it's you?
I mean, it really just feels like an extension of what I've always wanted to do, which is just share things. Now I suppose I'm lucky that people listen to me. I could have been screaming all of this into a void with having no one listening, but now I'm just lucky enough that I have an audience, and I can share there. You know, I want to share this beauty and this knowledge and this newness with people. So I suppose, yeah, I just feel grateful that people will listen. And I love to be helpful. I think that goes back to my Vogue days. I love to be helpful. I love to go the extra mile. Like, if someone DMs me, you know, I mean, I get the craziest DMs. I try to answer everything. Like, someone asked me yesterday, you know, where's the best place to stay in Paris with children? What arrondissement? Or, I need a wedding planner in Houston. I mean, I am, you know, I like to be helpful. I like to be useful. I like to share my knowledge.
So you're not like a hater, like, or competitive in that sense.
I don't think so. No. Like hating who?
Well, like if you got the best, let's say, house painter who did this incredible job, you would give it to all of your friends too. You wouldn't be like, no, I want to save that so that I want to save that for myself.
That's funny. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest. There are some times, you know, I have been burned in the past. I will give someone my trainer or my makeup artist or my hair stylist, and then they will move that person into their guest house and I suddenly can't get an appointment. So there are moments when I regret my oversharing. But on the whole, I mean, I think that's just part of what I do, and I'm flattered. I feel like it would almost be the opposite. If I recommended an amazing house painter and I told you why they are the best and I called that house painter, I'm like, you don't understand. She's going to call you. She's amazing. You're going to have this is going to be the best project. And then 6 weeks later, she's like, oh, I went with someone else. Like that would annoy me much more than I'm actually using the person that I recommended. I mean, I think that's just a hazard. I've noticed if it's someone I love who is inspired by something I do or say, then I'm like totally flattered by it. If it's someone who already annoys me, I'm like, ugh.
Yeah. What is your MO? I was going to ask you, like, even in work, sometimes you have to be around people who you just don't like. Do you have a MO in dealing with people like that?
Oh my God. I mean, are we really getting into that?
Well, meaning, do you kill people with kindness or do you tell them to fuck off, you know, and stand your ground?
I feel like people know how I feel about them. Yeah, I mean, we're really going there. I try to be nice to there are very few people in the world that annoy me that I can't find something amusing about or that I can't talk to. There are very few people. It would, you know, but if someone's a bore, they're a bore and I can probably avoid them. But there aren't that many people in the world that drive me bonkers. I could name them on one hand.
And they know it.
I imagine they know it. I'm, you know, or maybe not, you know, actually those people usually don't know, isn't that right? But I can go to avoid them, but I can really find something admirable in almost anyone, you know, sometimes I get a lot of people trying to, like they'll meet me and they want to maybe like impress me. Maybe they want to tell me like what they have or what they, you know, what they bought or, and that I could find someone like sort of braggy like that. I could find that maybe kind of annoying, but then I think to myself, I'm like, this person is just trying to, you know, they want me to think that, you know, or, you know, they're doing it in my opinion, usually the best intention. So, but that does happen a lot where I find that people, try to be that way with me.
I think you're very different in real life meeting you than people would expect. I can just say for myself, that you're really funny and also personable. And that we have a stereotype that if you worked in fashion and you, you know, are a quote unquote socialite, that you would be the ice queen and stuff. Do you find that people are really thrown off when they meet you versus what they think about you?
I think so. And I think that's why I sometimes get that people come to me at that angle. And then I'll try to shift it to, you know, their children or, you know, tried it, just shipped it to something else that's more real. And yeah, if I have to, I'll just make a really, you know, self-deprecating, really sort of, you know, outrageous joke or comment to let someone know, like, I'm not taking myself seriously. Like, you don't have to either, please, like, you know, join me in being, in not taking ourselves seriously.
Yeah, totally. How does it get complicated with like owning a company, being the face of a company, and then also having this, you know, you're a real human with opinions and a real life outside of work?
I really, you know, I took my lead from working for Anna, who was and is, you know, very outspoken, and she believes, you know, and she supports Democratic candidates, and she puts herself out there. And I think if she is able to do this, that then I can too.
Mm-hmm. Even if you piss some people off, it's worth it.
I mean, I piss people off if I'm talking about like hemlines, you know. So, I mean, like I made fun of scented candles once, and you know, people were outraged. So I'm not afraid of a little
conflict. Isn't that a terrible gift that now it's so played out to give someone a candle, or is it still okay?
Well, that's what I said. I said nothing says I don't care like a scented candle.
Yeah.
And people were really offended by that.
Now it's time for a game called Tried and True and Something New. Is there a beauty product that you have used forever that you just can't live without? And then is there something new that you're really crazy about?
Let's see. I have used forever. I have this fragrance that when I was in high school, Carolyn Bessette Kennedy she was like 10 years older than me. I had a friend whose sister was friends with her. And I had heard they'd snuck off to New York City to get this cool fragrance from a dodgy dealer on Canal Street. And I hopped on Metro North and went and found it. So I've been wearing that for a really long time.
Mm-hmm. Or the Canal Street version?
Canal Street.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's pretty dodgy. It's great. I may recreate it one day. Watch this space. And then I would say new is James de Givenchy of Tafan just released a bunch of fragrances. He has this really great, I want to say it's like orange or orange magnolia fragrance. That's fantastic. That has sort of made its way into my repertoire. We have it on Moda.
Well, that leads us right into Moda just launched a beauty site. Tell me about the site and why you decided to launch a beauty site on Moda.
I just love the idea. I feel like Moda really speaks to like a woman's lifestyle. And whether we have home or fine jewelry, that, you know, it's just like a more of a lifestyle, and beauty to me always felt like a big hole. I've always, you know, what I dreamed of with Moda was one day, you know, when I was focused on that big, huge goal, right? Mm-hmm. Was to be, you know, the world's greatest online, you know, like a Barney's, curated with, you know, heritage brands and up and coming brands, discovery brands, the best beauty and shoes. And that's sort of what I always aspired, to. And so beauty was just a small step, as we were saying, in that very big, goal. I'm sort of filling those shoes of Barney's, RIP.
So does the beauty have a certain, what would you describe as its kind of essence of the beauty site or the angle? Is it like your Lauren's favorite luxury products? Is it all about, you know, what would you say?
I think it mirrors Moda's unique point of view, where it is a mix of heritage brands. We have, you know, La Mer, we have doctor brands like Dr. Sturm, or Augustinia's Butter, And then we have, you know, new up and coming beauty brands. So, and that's how we approach fashion. That's how we approach home. So we just continue that philosophy on, you know, on in our beauty department. And I think what we're trying to do is have a really unique point of view. So you know that everything, whether it's a designer or a beauty product, has been vetted. It's something we believe in. We think it's cool and in the know, and what people, whether in fashion circles or beauty circles, are talking about and excited about. And I'm, you know, and I want to share those amazing finds or amazing products with our audience.
That's great. This is a final question that I ask everyone on the show is, if you could go back in time and meet with yourself, when would it be and what would you say?
Let's see, probably around like 25 or 26, where I gained a sense of self-awareness. I think before that, when you're like a kid or a college student, or, at least I had no sense of self-awareness. And then all of a sudden, like age 25, probably when I'm in New York at Vogue, I was cursed with self-awareness. You know, and I think I would tell myself that you are going to make so many mistakes, sometimes in the same day. And that every day, you know, there will be something that you did or regret or didn't do or should have done, you know, just in general, make a mistake. And you will make a mistake every single day for the rest of your life and just get over it and move on. And everyone else does. And to just, you know, move on. It took me like maybe I'd say like 10 years, 15 years to figure that out on my own. Wow. And I would, you know, if I made a mistake, I would just stew on it. And, you know, I'd be scared to, if I hurt someone, to apologize, to have a confrontation, to own up or even own up to something that I had done, take responsibility, you know, try to forget or push down or ignore or, you know, and it just took me, you know, just like, I always call it like crippling self-awareness. And that eventually I just learned that everyone feels that they are constantly making mistakes, either doing things or not doing things that they regret, or, you know, big or small. And that it's once you learn to move on, that's when, you know, real progress can be made.
Yeah. Love that. To round out the end of the show, Lauren, it's a rapid fire game.
Okay.
So here we go. You can only wear one designer for the rest of your life. Who is it?
Proença Schouler.
City with the best shopping?
Tokyo.
Public figure with the best style?
Carolyn Bessette Kennedy.
Newest party trend?
Low-key sleazy.
I'd be a natural for that. Farthest you've ever traveled for a destination wedding?
Morocco.
The one shoe that goes with everything?
One shoe that goes with everything. That doesn't exist. Sorry.
Okay. favorite New York restaurant?
Oh my God. St. Ambrose Lafayette.
Okay. Oh, the Lafayette. They all have their own kind of like crowd. I always totally think the Lafayette crowd are the like trust fund fashion-y kids. You know, like a lower, you know, like West Village is like you might see Pat McGrath and like the old guard fashion crowd, yeah. Right?
I feel like Lafayette, it's a bit like old school downtown Cipriani.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Balthazar or Polo Lounge?
Polo Lounge. I feel terrible saying that. I mean, that's a self-own. My God. Has it come to this?
it's come to this.
Oh my God, it's come to this. I am now painfully self-aware that I have become aged and gentrified. My God.
Exactly. London or Paris?
Paris.
MoMA or the Met?
Met.
Met Gala or Art Basel?
Met Gala. Art Basel's a pain in the ass.
It's the worst. Housewives of New York or Housewives of LA?
I'm more like a million-dollar listing.
Oh. Kind of
girl. Yeah, I'm waiting for the new cast of New York. And let's check
in. Did they
in.
Ask you to be on it?
Yes, and I'm like offended when they do, and I'm offended when they don't.
I've met like 7 girls who are like, yeah, they wanted me to be on that. I just can't.
Yeah, yeah.
Vanity Fair or New York Times?
Oh my God, neither. Washington Post.
Oh. And DeSantis or Trump?
Oh my God. You know what? I know. I have my own reasons. But I think Trump. I'm actually more afraid of DeSantis than I am of Trump. Trump will be like
smarter, fitting
himself in adult diapers
right.
in a few years, whereas DeSantis is like a mini tyrant and like more clever and less demented.
Yeah. Yep. And finally, Diet Coke or Diet Prada?
Diet Prada.
Well, Lauren, that was so fun. That went by so quickly for me. I just love talking to you always and hearing your take on things. And I can't thank you enough for being a guest in my chair.
Thanks so much for having me, and congratulations on all your success. Everyone, like people are always talking about your podcast. So I am so happy to be on it. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. And hope to see you soon.
Thanks. Big kiss.
Bye.